Thanks very much for your kind introduction, and thanks to Andras for your kind invitation. What I will do is I will discuss the prohibition of incitement to religious hatred under international law. What I will do first is give you a couple of examples of what I will be talking about, and but also what I won't be talking about. Starting with the latter. Here you see a cartoon sort of alluding to the view that Scientology is a fraud and that they're after your money. So this would be a clear example of religious defamation, not necessarily incitement. I'm not saying that this particular example qualifies under the prohibition of incitement, but at least what you see here is an incitement to certain action. So the first guy is saying to the other guy, I'm an atheist. Then the other guy says, I'm a Christian. Third person shows up on the scene, I'm a Scientologist. Upon which the atheist and the Christian beats the living daylights out of the Scientologist. So is this incitement? Well, the reason why I give you this example is because in order to know whether this falls under the international ban on incitement, you would need to know more details. Importantly, you would need to know the overall context. You would need to know whether it's actually likely that upon reading this, members of the audience, members of the public, readers, are more likely than to either discriminate Scientologists or actually engage in violent acts. Another question you may ask, perhaps, is what is actually the intent of the author? What if I would say to you that the intent of the author is not to incite violence against Scientology, but to show that Christians can be very violent against Scientologists, which places this cartoon in a completely different perspective. So that begs the question of intent, of mens rea, under this particular clause. Well, numerous other examples I could give you. The previous examples were religion versus religion, if you will. Advocacy of religious hatred begs the question, how do we define religious hatred? Does it mean always one religion vis-a-vis another religion? Or could it also be religiously motivated hatred, which could also be against women, could be against LGBT groups, etc. So that's another question to be asked about international law. How far do those standards on incitement stretch? Another interesting question is religious liberties. So this particular man was convicted of incitement to terrorism. We will hear about that more in the next presentation. The question is, how far can you play the trump card of religious liberties in this case? What if he would say, which he did, what I'm doing is not inciting terrorism. What I'm doing is explaining my view on this particular holy book. The British judge didn't buy that, clearly, and convicted him to many years imprisonment. Well, we've seen the Danish cartoon examples. We've seen many recent examples along those lines. Other questions you may ask are about the status and the position of the alleged inciter. So politicians, first and foremost, are ambiguous in that respect, because on the one hand, they have a very important role and position in a democratic society, clearly. And on the other, they have a position in which they exercise a lot of influence, potentially at least. These three were all prosecuted over their alleged incitement. Some were convicted, like Le Pen. Some were acquitted, like Wilders. Another position or status is the one of academics. Here, academics in inverted commas, because these were notorious Holocaust deniers. We've heard something about that in the previous presentation. I will get back to that in a second. and then perhaps most pertinent to this particular conference, the position of journalists. Again, very important in a democratic society, clearly. Here, the question of intent, once again, becomes very pertinent. Jerseholt was convicted in Denmark under incitement laws, under hate speech laws. What he did was make a program, a television program, about extremists, about fascists, neo-Nazis in Denmark. The Danish judge interpreted in a very narrow, in a very broad way, in a sense, saying what you literally did by making this television program is disseminate extremist views. The European Court said, no, wait a minute. The objective of this program was to discuss extremist views, which serves a public interest, and he shouldn't have been convicted under this type of laws. Okay, these examples, just to set the scene, just to raise more questions than actually answer them. I try to answer a couple of those questions in what follows now. So what I will do now is compare the workings of the European Court of Human Rights very briefly with the workings of the United Nations Human Rights Committee in this area. And the interesting thing about the European Convention on Human Rights is that it doesn't contain an incitement clause, right? There's freedom of expression, there's a general abuse of rights clause in Article 17, but there's no equivalent to, say, Article 20 of the ICCPR. There's no incitement clause in the European Convention, which perhaps has fueled the problematic situation wherein the court has accepted, has permitted all sorts of restrictions on speech which are of a far lower threshold than incitement. So defamation, religious defamation restrictions, far more general hate speech restrictions, but even blasphemy restrictions are permitted in a couple of decisions of the European Court of Human Rights. And I find that problematic. I find, first of all, problematic that the court reads into Article 9 of the European Convention a right to not be insulted in your religious views, so to have your religious sensitivities protected. I find that to be stretching the nature of the right to freedom of religion, which, after all, includes a right to have a religion, to change that religion, to practice a religion, but in my mind, not to have your sensitivities always respected. And even then, if there would be an abstract clash between freedom of expression and freedom of religion, to my mind, the European Court fails in many of these cases to really show the necessity of the interference. So take those cases like Otto Preminger. The court reasons, there's so many Catholics here in this region, surely they're going to be outraged by this particular blasphemous movie. I would argue if you reverse the argument, it's 10 times stronger. There's so many Catholics in this region, their rights are not going to be undermined by a small art house film mocking their views. They can still practice their religion, they can still have hold their religious views. Third objection is that whereas the UK blasphemy law has now been annulled, when it was still in place, the court essentially argued we don't care that it's inherently discriminatory, that it protects only one particular religion. Whereas I would argue that many of these blasphemy laws, they protect the predominant religion, and that it as such disqualifies them from being legitimate limitations. All right, moving back then from blasphemy and defamation to incitement. How could the European Court then deal with promote limitations on free speech to the level of incitement kind of limitations? It has been suggested in the literature that the court could perhaps mobilize Article 17 more, which the court has done in the past. My problem with Article 17 is that it's really an admissibility question, which means that you would rob religious leaders and politicians essentially of a lot of their free speech, because the question then will be dealt with under admissibility rather than on the merits of the complaint. Turning then to the international, to the UN standards, which contain more concrete incitement standards. Article 20, paragraph 2, ICCPR, any advocacy of religious hatred that constitutes incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence shall be prohibited by law. It's a very convoluted and vague standard. The way I've tried to conceptualize this in the book that was kindly mentioned previously is by describing this norm, this standard, as a as focusing on a triangle of incitements. So this is the fundamental difference with blasphemy laws and defamation laws. What you need for incitement to be to occur is that an inciter addresses a third party, an audience, and mobilizes that audience to commit adverse acts vis-a-vis the target group. So the target group is the subject of the speech, for instance, a religious minority, but the audience is the group potentially acting upon that speech. And what you would need to know under the necessity criterion is how likely it actually is that such will occur. And in order to put a finger on that question of likelihood, you would need to balance the content of the speech with the context of the speech. And I would argue that the context of the speech is by far the most important factor, most important criterion. So you could, where do I see the time besides? Where do I see it? Where do I see the time?
Time. Oh, yes.
Okay. I got it. So context questions you would want to ask are, again, and this pertains to a couple of the examples I gave at the beginning. So what is the position of the advocator or the inciter? You would also need to discern how far the speech reaches, what the medium used, the setting of the speech. But particularly important is the question of how vulnerable the target group is, which can range from a fairly protected group to a extremely vulnerable group. And factors that indicate that are, for instance, the number of hate crimes perpetrated against that group. A couple of my examples at the beginning, back to the question of intent. So what I've tried to do in the book is also answer the question to what extent is mens rea required under international standards on incitement. I came up with a threefold test, very much influenced by the work of Article 19 in this area, the free speech NGO. But slightly more demanding even than their test. And I think the reason why I'm so demanding on the question of intent is to really try to nip potential of abuse in the bud. So First of all, you would need to prove the intention to actually disseminate the hateful message. So if you would send a hateful email privately to a person, that would not qualify. Even if that person would then go to the police, say, this is hateful, it might qualify under other kind of criminal law, but it would not qualify under incitement. And there are actually a couple of European court cases where this did lead, this kind of personal hate messages did lead to convictions which were upheld. Secondly, you would need to prove the intention to target a specific group, like a religious community. And third, and most difficult probably to prove, is you would need to prove the intention to incite discrimination or violence. If you looked closely at Article 20, paragraph 2, there's also another ground listed there, hostility. In the book, I also describe how I dismiss that particular ground for being overly vague. So I focus here mostly on discrimination or violence. This would be extremely difficult to prove for a prosecutor, which would mean that prosecutorial practice will revolve around the most heinous type of cases. Clearly, from the perspective of persecuted minorities, that's a downside. From the perspective of promoting free speech, that's a plus. That also means that I dismiss lower criteria like recklessness or a reasonable person criterion. And again, my reason for doing so is from the perspective of free speech protection. And a final question. I will skip over the Wilders slides because Wilders had been mentioned and seen on the picture before. A final question, not often addressed in the context of hate speech debates, is to what extent can you distill from international standards on incitement a substantive fundamental right to be free from successful incitement to violence. And the UN Human Rights Committee has circumvented this question. It has been posed this question a couple of times. And in those cases, like Maria Fassilari, other cases, it has literally said, we're not going to answer this, and they found other reasons to dismiss those cases. Ironically, paradoxically, it's the European Court of Human Rights, and again, the European Convention lacks an incitement clause. It's the European Court of Human Rights that increasingly distills from the Convention such a right, which started in the Aksu case, dealing with publications, dictionaries that were stereotyping Roma people. And whereas the court then rejected the claims, the pertinence of those cases lies in the fact that the cases were declared admissible. So the applicant, the Roma person, had actual standing to bring this complaint under Article 8 on private life, which was the first step towards accepting a right to be protected against incitement. And very, very recently, in the Karamet case, I think it's February or March 2015, the first successful complaint of this type was made under Article 9. So again, this is not what I talked about previously, a right to be to have your religious sensitivities protected, but this would be a right to be protected from incitement. I think I'll leave it at that. Thanks very much for your attention.